Ms. Campbell?
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Stanley Campbell, and I am here on behalf of Booker Sewell. Mr. Sewell wants me to convince you that you should set aside, reverse the ruling of the district court on our motion to suppress and find that the affidavit in support of the search warrant did not contain sufficient information, didn't establish probable cause. I want to focus on two aspects of it, and that is that there wasn't evidence to establish that Booker Sewell was residing or was associated with the condominium unit on Sawmill Woods Court that was leased in the name of Martine Sewell, and also that it failed to establish any nexus between any alleged criminal activity and that residence located at Sawmill Woods Court. As to the second of those two, nexus between any alleged criminal activity and the residence located at Sawmill Woods Court, there isn't anything in the affidavit indicating that there was any drug activity at the Sawmill Woods Court residence. The only reference to Sawmill Woods Court is from a time in March of 2011 when Silvestre Castaneda, who was Booker Sewell's supplier, his vehicle was tracked to the vicinity of the Sawmill Woods Court residence. That's all there was. There was a GPS unit that had been placed on Mr. Castaneda's vehicle. So the most we know from that is that the vehicle that the GPS unit was on was parked in the vicinity of that Sawmill Woods Court residence. There wasn't any visual surveillance to establish either that Sylvester Castaneda was there or anything else about what happened on that occasion.
Well, there wasn't any question of the fact that that's where he spent the evening. That's where he lived, right?
Castaneda or Sewell? Sewell, you mean? Booker,
yeah.
Sewell? Yeah, Booker Sewell. We believe there is not sufficient evidence to establish that. And I want to start there with what wasn't contained within the affidavit of probable cause. There wasn't anything in the affidavit of probable cause to establish that his name was on any record of ownership or leases to the property. There weren't any utility bills in his name. There wasn't any evidence of any mail in his name that was ever received at that address. There were no vehicles that were registered to that address in his name. There wasn't any, and this was an investigation that went on for over a year, and there wasn't any visual surveillance of Booker Sewell during this entire time period.
Was there any suggestion that he was married to the woman who lived there?
Yes, that was contained within the affidavit of probable cause.
Doesn't that really account for all those things that you're talking about?
Not in our view, for this reason. There was not any visual surveillance to establish him coming or going, which would have been an easy enough matter to establish that he was living there. The only thing in the affidavit tying him to Sawmill Woods Court was an indication that there were some police reports from March 2010, December 2010, and February 2011, indicating that the police had information or were called there because of Booker Sewell's presence there. Now, there's nothing to establish where that information came from, the source of the information. So how reliable is it? It was something that was simply contained within Fort Wayne Police Department database. But the affidavit goes on to say that the February 2011 incident in which Booker Sewell was reported to be at the Sawmill Woods Court residence resulted in a protective order being issued against Booker Sewell. Protective order saying that he was to stay away from Martine Sewell and not be any place that Martine Sewell was at. So in our view, that would be evidence to the reverse, to the contrary, that he wasn't at that address because of a protective order that had been issued. Strong evidence that he wasn't there. Now, the government, or in the affidavit, the agent tries to get around that by saying, well, in his training experience, oftentimes these protective orders are ignored. People don't pay attention to them. Well, maybe that's true, maybe it's not. I don't know. But the point is, insofar as the affidavit is concerned, he doesn't indicate he has any training or experience in domestic disputes or in protective orders. What he says in the affidavit, the way he starts out on page one, is that he has expertise and training in white collar crime. He has expertise and training in Italian organized crime matters, arsons, drugs, money laundering, those sorts of things. But there's nothing in there to indicate that he has any experience in domestic disputes or protective orders. That's simply a statement that he's making that we can assume in these cases that protective orders are ignored. We don't know that. But the best...
I wouldn't say it's universally known, but it is... It's apparent from a judicial position that they are often ignored from a judge's point of view. Now, whether that applies to this officer or not is another issue.
Well, I guess the question is whether they are ignored enough so that they become a basis for probable cause for the issuance of a search warrant. And we would suggest the answer to that is no. Without some sort of empirical studies, without some sort of statistical analysis or presentation, without someone verifying who has some training experience, background in handling domestic cases, cop on the beat maybe, who deals a lot with protective order situations, I don't know, but not an FBI agent who doesn't have any training experience in those matters, just simply saying it in the affidavit. In our view, it's not enough. So we don't think there was a sufficient connection between Mr. Sewell and the Sawmill Woods Court residence. And insofar as the allegation that there may be evidences of drug trafficking found at that residence, again, there's nothing in the affidavit to establish any drug activity going on at the Sawmill Woods Court residence.
Well, how do you, Mr. Campbell, account for the early March telephone conversations between Castaneda and Sewell?
Between Sewell and Castaneda?
Yeah.
I think those were...
Well, let me just, if I may, and then the eventual visit by Castaneda to the residence. You don't think that's sufficient linkage, that that site is connected to drug trafficking, if you assume that the overhearings indicated a dealing in drugs?
It's something, Judge. I'll acknowledge that. I think what you're referring to, there was a phone call between Sewell and Castaneda on March 8, where Castaneda's out of town, and he says he'll be back in a couple days.
Well, yeah, they speak on the 1st and the 3rd, don't they?
Yes, they do. Uh-huh. And then March the 12th is the date of that electronic surveillance, where at least the Castaneda's vehicle was in the vicinity of Sawmill Woods Court.
Right.
On the following day, March 13th, there's a phone call between Castaneda and Booker Sewell where Castaneda says he's waiting on his friend, suggesting that he's waiting on his friend who's going to be providing him with the drugs that he's going to be delivering to Sewell, I guess. The government in its brief had said that, well, we can assume, and there's obvious case law that says cash, drugs, ledgers, guns, stuff like that can be found at drug dealers' residences, drug traffickers' residences, and that's true enough.
In fact, it often is. Most of the cases we have, if you read the cases, involve not street corner transactions, but dealings within a residence.
Drug houses, yes. One point is that we don't feel there's been a sufficient connection to show that was a residence of Booker Sewell. The other thing that I'd like to point out is if you look at the affidavit itself, what Agent Karzai says that in his training and experience, and this is on page 60 of the affidavit, it's common for drug traffickers to keep cash in a variety of locations. He doesn't say in the affidavit, and I've seen these in affidavits, that it's common in his training experience for drug traffickers to keep cash or guns or ledgers at their residence. That's not what this affidavit says. This affidavit says that it's common in his training experience for drug traffickers to keep this stuff, cash, drugs, guns, ledgers, at a variety of locations, which leads to the question, I think, what basis does he have for believing that it's at this location rather than some other location where they're likely to find these evidences of drug trafficking? He says that in his affidavit, he says that in his training experience, it's common for drug traffickers to keep, this is at page 61 of the affidavit, to maintain books, records, receipts, notes, or other ledgers to keep track of money owed, but he doesn't say anything in the affidavit specifically about where it's common in his training experience to find these things. He simply says that it's common for them to keep these records and ledgers, but nothing in the affidavit about where we might likely find them. So, it's the same thing with packaging material. He makes a reference in the affidavit to common to find packaging material for drug traffickers. And in this specific case, there was testimony, or they had evidence that the cocaine was coming in metal cans from California, so they were looking for metal cans, and he refers to that. But again, there's nothing in the affidavit to indicate why he had any basis for believing that drug wrapping material, paraphernalia, or metal cans would be found at this particular residence as opposed to any place else. It's simply a statement that this is what we're looking for. It's common in my experience and training to find ledgers and to find packaging material, to find guns. Drug dealers carry guns, but there's nothing in the affidavit that says we're likely to find it at the Sawmill Woods Court residence.
All right. Are you going to reserve some time, Mr. Campbell?
Yes.
Oh, you didn't reserve?
I did not, no.
But well, you have it if you need it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Mr. Geller.
Good morning. My name is Tony Geller, and I'm here on behalf of the United States of America. May it please the Court. I'll discuss the main issues that Mr. Campbell has discussed in his argument. I think the place to start, though, is standard review. As the Court knows, when you have the issuance of a search warrant, the issuing magistrate is accorded great deference, and the issue is whether or not whether there are other inferences that can be made or other things that maybe could have been placed in the search warrant, but the issue is whether the information in the affidavit provides probable cause or whether there's a substantial basis in the affidavit to lead us to probable cause. In other words, is there just a fair probability that evidence might be located in this residence and that it's tied to drug trafficking?
I have just a preliminary question. As far as this, I guess you want to call it the search, were there several that were executed concurrently?
There were, Your Honor.
How many of those, or if you know?
In this particular affidavit, there were seven different residences.
And
that
Sewell's
were
discussed. Is just one of them at the same time.
That is correct, yes.
So there's several locations that they are looking at.
Yes.
And each one has, I guess, these people subordinate to, what's his name, Castaneda, whatever his name is he's the one that ultimately testifies. I assume he's obviously a key witness. These are basically his subordinates that these seven people?
Yes, Your Honor. I would consider Sylvester Castaneda, to be more or less the ringleader of this particular conspiracy. The affidavit covers, in essence, the conspiracy and those obtaining drugs from the conspiracy. So there is a lot of detail on the different individual conspirators, right, and Castaneda's activity. individuals like his brother Pedro Castaneda, Osiris Espinoza, those types of people, Maritza Castaneda, his sister, those are primarily his conspirators. Booker Sewell was one of his primary customers who was also involved in getting drugs from the conspiracy. So the affidavit does address seven different locations, but it addresses the seven locations that are relevant to this particular conspiracy.
And well, I think, Mr. Geller,
yes, sir.
Tell me what we have in addition to the fact that Sewell's wife is the tenant, the responsible person for the apartment, and the visit of Castaneda. As to why would you could search this site? Do we have anything beyond those two things?
Yes, we do. For one, Your Honor, you have to consider, and I think one of your questions alluded to this, you have to consider the context of that March the 12th visit by Mr. Castaneda to the residence. On March the 1st, the recorded call indicated that Mr. Sewell had ordered up one, which we can infer was 1 kilogram of cocaine based on all the information in the affidavit. On March the 8th, Mr. Castaneda is still in California, says he's coming back in 2 days. Booker Sewell says that he is ready, good indication he's ready for the transaction. And then on March the 10th, there's actually a seizure. There is a seizure of 3 kilograms of cocaine in one of the inbound packages. So that is the context that we're dealing with. So that's part of how we know what's going on here, that it is going to be a drug transaction. So then if you look at the calls that are mentioned in the affidavit on the 12th, in the midst of those calls, about 15 minutes or so prior to Mr. Castaneda's visit to Mr. Sewell, there is a call with a fellow by the name of De Luna, Florencio De Luna. He's one of the stash house operators for Mr. Castaneda, one of his conspirators. Approximately 15 minutes before the visit to Mr. Sewell, there's calls with De Luna discussing essentially alternate plans and how to replace the 3 kilos that were just intercepted by law, or at least that were lost. They, of course, didn't know law enforcement had intercepted them at that time. And then immediately after the visit with Mr. Sewell, there are discussions between Castaneda and the big boss down in Mexico about, you know, essentially how to adjust their shipping methods and continue to provide and ship cocaine in. So I think if you consider the context, that's one thing of March the 12th. The other thing, though, judges, is there is a long, ongoing relationship that Mr. Sewell has with that residence. I mean, Your Honor pointed out, of course, the natural and reasonable inference that a husband would live with his wife. That's certainly part of it, but also you have Mr. Sewell for an entire year up until that incident in February. March 2010, there's a police report, and he's there at the house. The next one in December of 2010, again, and the police report indicates and connects him to that residence, again, the residence of his wife. And then finally you have, just a month before that March 12th visit by Castaneda, yet another police report where Mr. Sewell is there at the house. So it's not just that there's this one visit by Mr. Castaneda, but there is this year-long, you know, worth of activity and police contacts with Mr. Sewell associating him and placing him at that residence. So there is considerably more information. And again, what we're getting down to here is not necessarily what's not in the affidavit. The issue is whether or not these facts provide us with a substantial basis to credit the inferences of the issuing magistrate, considering that great deference standard. As far as the nexus is concerned, that was the next issue that Mr. Campbell brought up. Really, it comes down to this court's rulings in the Redrick case and in the many cases that follow Redrick concerning the very eminently reasonable inference that drug dealers will store drug evidence where they live, where they operate. In this case, one of your honors asked a question or at least mentioned a sort of a contrast between street drug dealing and what we have here. When you're dealing with kilo level dealers of cocaine, it's a completely different ballgame. I mean, you're dealing with sophisticated individuals who are looking at, you know, considerably more time and money invested in these sorts of things. They're looking at a lot more penalty potentially. So their tactics are considerably different. You see a lot of information in the affidavit about rather sophisticated counter-surveillance measures and all these other different things. There's a considerable evidence of concealment, or at least of activity of concealment by Castaneda and by Mr. Sewell. You have the switching of telephones. In 2 months, Castaneda used 3 different telephones, and Mr. Sewell kept up with that. Mr. Sewell himself used 2 different telephones. So we have all that. So when you consider this, the nexus element, I would ask the court to consider the expertise of the agent. What he's talking about in there is that there's a lot of different types of evidence, not only cocaine, but cocaine dealers, especially at the kilo level, have to have cash on hand. And we know Mr. Sewell has cash on hand because there are a number of calls where he provides Castaneda with money, kind of whenever he's getting ready to go to California on another cocaine-finding trip. Mr. Sewell provides him some money to kind of keep him going. So we know Mr. Sewell has a cash hoard that he accesses frequently.
Could you describe, sort of a unique thing, these soup cans? Shipping in soup cans.
Yes, Your Honor.
That seems to be a unique device that I assume would be found in various places. What is it?
It's quite clever in this case. What they're doing, instead of having a courier transport the cocaine across country from California after being imported from Mexico, from California to Indiana, what they're doing is shipping it through commercial shipping companies, UPS and FedEx. This information is all in the affidavit, but what they've done is they have a fellow who actually makes a wooden box that will fit precisely inside the FedEx or UPS cardboard box in order so that if it's dropped, it's not broken and the contents exposed. Inside that box, and this is the way the March 10th seizure occurred, there were six of these sort of gallon-sized soup cans. Three of those contained an actual soup, or menudo in this case, and three of them were cans that were actually sealed up through a can sealer that had kilograms of cocaine inside that were also inside heat-sealed plastic bags. The idea being that you thwart a dog alert, and the dog did not alert to the March 10th. You know, of course, we had the wiretap, so we knew precisely what was going on. But in this case, that's the purpose for the cans.
Okay, that's it. Thank you.
Continuing with the nexus, and just a brief point back on the other issue, Mr. Campbell mentioned how does this FBI agent who works organized crime know anything about domestic violence? Well, he's forgetting about the FBI agent's prior experience. The FBI agent was a street cop with the South Bend Police Department for 6 years. He worked patrol. He worked investigations as a detective, and then he was a sergeant as well. So this is an individual who has street experience with a lot more than just drug offenses and white collar and so forth. So I think that's something that you may consider. And as Your Honor pointed out, it's even a reasonable inference that Magistrate Cosby could have made just as by virtue of his experience as a judge as well. So as far as the nexus is concerned, the FBI agent points out that, you know, when you have a sophisticated kilo dealer, they don't have utility bills. They don't have phones in their name. They don't drive vehicles in their name. They use residences that are in somebody else's name because that way if something is found, you have sort of this plausible deniability. You know, it's not my stuff because I didn't have my name on anything. And so that's the context that we're dealing with. It's unsurprising that we would not find those things. And that's why these types of drug dealers like Mr. Sewell use the residences of others, including their spouses, to distance themselves from those sorts of things. So, and I suppose the bottom line with all of this is you know, even if there's some issue with this, there's always a good faith exception. There's no evidence whatsoever that Magistrate Cosby did not, or that abandoned his neutral role. There's certainly a lot of information in that warrant that gets us through and gets us by the good faith exception. So I just ask the court to consider that as well.
Right. Thank you very Mr. much. Mr. Campbell, did you have anything further?
A couple of things. Insofar as the street experience of Agent Kazai and the use by drug dealers of their spouses' residences for the storage of paraphernalia or drugs or cash, that may be. But there's nothing about those things in this affidavit. And our position is, or our suggestion is, that in deciding whether or not there's probable cause based upon the affidavit to cause an issuance of the search warrant, you can't consider things that maybe are true, maybe aren't true, but aren't contained within the pages of the affidavit. The other thing is, the government says, well, Martine Sewell and Booker Sewell had a long continuing relationship. Again, there's nothing about that in the affidavit. We don't know if they'd been married 6 months or 30 years. Sometimes people who are married have solid relationships. Sometimes they live in different places. And we would suggest that when you have some incident reports, and particularly the last one, February 2011, that results in a protective order, that's pretty good indication that it's not a good relationship. And the protective order that was issued in February 2011 before the search warrant application says that Mr. Sewell's not to be there. That was Martine Sewell applying to a court and getting an order that he wasn't supposed to be there. So our position is that that is evidence that he wasn't residing there.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Thank you, Mr. Geller. Mr. Campbell, you were appointed in this case.
I was.
And I want you to have the additional thanks of the court for accepting this appointment and ably representing Mr. Sewell. Case is taken under advisement.